Anyway, I've labeled this sermon, We Two Kings of Orion Are. No, the last part is not there. There's a song, actually, people say at Christmas time, We Three Kings of Orient Are. This is We Two Kings. As all of us know, the Middle East is constantly heating up. It seems like if we have a week where nothing happens in the Middle East, you can almost bet that something's going to happen the following week. Especially, of course, since ISIS or ISIL, depending on who's talking, has become a new organization trying to take over and be the organization. And it seems every one of these terrorist groups wants to claim that they are the ones for the terror that's happened the previous week. They want to gain individuals joining their group. It's quite the time. We've had Iraq around for a long time, another war that the United States has lost. We did not win that at all, and I think there's been books written concerning the war and the disaster, I guess we could say, in Iraq. And, of course, they're wanting us to put troops on the ground over there because the airstrikes aren't doing enough. But we have Syria, of course, who's, what, lost half of their population. 10,000 people or so have died. We have Yemen. It's come up yesterday with the Shiites basically taking over. Then you have Al-Qaeda doing its thing, as I mentioned, and ISIS, and, of course, negotiations going on with Iran. And that is over the nuclear armament. Basically, they don't say it that way, but we know that's what it's over. And now the king of Saudi Arabia who's dying, and the question mark there as to what's going to happen. But always something going on in the Middle East, always. And it's been happening ever since 1949, maybe, and before that. But in 49, when the Jews took over, and they were the terrorists, by the way. The Israelites were the terrorists, with the King David Hotel being blown up. I think they were the ones doing that. So while the world has their eyes on the Middle East, at the same time, there's not the same focus on Europe, except for maybe the economic stimulus of $1 trillion plus in bonds that are going to be sold to follow the wonderful example, I might say, of the United States and how we are so good in getting out of debt over here, whatever the case. And I don't know if the Chinese and Japanese are buying up those bonds or not. But definitely, when you take a look, the two kings, and the kings that I'm talking about, of course, will be the king of the north and the king of the south. But when you take a look at the two kings, you can see a lot of attention being focused on an area that will have the king of the south, and not too much attention focused at this time on the king of the north. But If you take a look at individuals or countries, I guess leaders, looking for a solution to the problems in the Middle East, they do look to, not Europe, but they look to Germany. You can see that. What is Germany going to be doing about this? And Merkel herself knows that the world has their eyes on her because they are the dominant nation over there, without a doubt. They're the muscle in Europe. They're the only ones that can really do anything. They have, in the short term, not wanted to go into the Middle East, although they've helped a little bit, but they have sent some weapons down there. But what are they going to do? They don't like the Middle East being stirred up. They don't really like the Jews, do they? Weren't they the ones that were so nice to the Jews in World War II? So they don't really like Israel. You know they don't. But they don't like what's going on with all the terrorist groups either. So the sermon today is going to basically function or focus around the two kings, the king of the north and the king of the south. We in the church really are blessed, when you stop to think of it, that we know the importance of watching the Middle East. We know the importance of how the Middle East will fit into the end time. We know that. We take it for granted. If you ask an average guy on the street, well, how is the world going to come to an end? And first of all, of course, they would say, well, the world coming to an end, thank you very much. Is this gin or is it vodka? Oh, it's spiced up. So how is the world going to come to an end? The world coming to an end. Nobody thinks in terms of the world coming to an end. Not like back in the 1950s and the early 1960s, before the collapse, we said, of Russia, or of the USSR, better yet. But the world is completely, totally ignorant. And we just know, we have studied this, if we were born into the church, been around for 60 years or so, we know, reading the old plain truths, that these things have been prophesied, interpreted properly in an overall overview we have. And so we just know that there's going to be a rising once again of a major northern king who will have a number of kings under him. And there's going to be some problems down in the south. And in the past we've said it'll be oil where they're going to push at or cause war against the north because of oil. And that's questionable now. But whatever the case, we just knew it, didn't we? We've just known it. It was I've taken it for granted since I've been 16 years old because that's when I started reading it. That was when I was young, middle age now, young before then, young age then. But whatever the case, it's just something we know in the church. And we sit here and you say, yes, go on with the sermon. We already know that. But I think we do need to do an overview because as things begin to heat up, we might take for granted that this is nothing different than what happened in the middle 60s, because things were heating up there. This is nothing different than any other time when you have the Middle East and the problems, and then it dies down, and it's just going to continue, and it's almost like this wolf, wolf, and wolf, wolf now, it doesn't faze us at all. Does not faze us. It's interesting in the Jeremiah Bible study with Mr. Ralph Levy how in Israel they thought that they were not going to be attacked because a few years earlier they were being attacked, the city was being surrounded, and those armies pulled back. And the king went home, and I believe it was his sons that killed him. And they were thinking, well, we have the temple here, and if you've been following the Jeremiah Bible study, and you can pick it up later if you haven't had time to get into it now, but they were thinking, God saved us before, and we have the temple here, and that's probably why he saved us before, and as long as we have the temple, we're going to be okay. And we had 9/11. And we think, well, God really, you know, saved us. And we've all forgotten about that. We haven't, but the world has. So I think we should focus on the end time once again here and see, based on what's happening in the world today, what is going to happen. Based on what's happening, what is going to happen. So let's go to Daniel 7. Let me take a swig of this gin. Okay, Daniel 7, we'll go to some basic scriptures that we've read before, but it's good to take a look at them. The overview is, first of all, in Daniel on the king of the north. Then we'll go to just an overview scripture on the king of the south. So the first one is in Daniel 7, in verse 1, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream. Interesting. He woke up, and I don't know if you've ever done this, but you wake up and you remember a dream and you like to, maybe you think of writing it down, and then later on you tell your wife, your husband, man, I had the weirdest dream. Man, I wish I would have made a note of it because I forgot. But he woke up and he wrote these things down. So Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Mediterranean Sea. This is the sea closest to him, probably not the Black Sea, I wouldn't think. So Daniel spoke, saying, it stirred up the great sea, and four great beasts came from the sea, each different from the other. First like a lion, with eagle's wings, I watched till its wings were plucked off. It was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Suddenly another beast, a second, like a bear. It was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Of course, we've seen the pictures of these beasts, and we've had this explained to us, and it goes on to give explanation, of course. But then it says in verse 7, after this I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, exceedingly strong. It had huge iron teeth. It was devouring, breaking in pieces, and trampling the residue with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Now, in the explanation, it goes on to tell us that this is the scenario of verse 7, this fourth beast that takes place right before Christ returns. And so we know the picture, and it's going to describe it, and we'll come back later to Daniel 7 for some of the details to see what Daniel was really, really interested in. There was something in this dream that really caught his attention. And so when the explanation came as to who the bear was and the eagle, he said, yes, but I want to know something. And so we'll come back to that. But this was the end time, because we see in verse 13, I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the cloud of heavens. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near him. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom. So the dream that he had, or the vision that he had in the dream, was about the end time and what was taking place with some powers before the final power would come. And again, we'll come back to it. But it's end time, and it's this beast, and he is the king. He will be the king of the north. Psalm 83. Now, when we come to the king of the south, we have more questions. At least I do. And if any of you have some inside view on this, if you've had a vision lately, I'd like to maybe not hear it. We'll just call it a nightmare if you had it, right? But anyway, Psalm 83. And I'd remember this was in here when I was putting the sermon together, and I was thinking it was in Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel, because it was a rundown of what would take place with a group. And it's not. It's Psalm. It's a Psalm 83 concerning God putting down the enemies of Israel. And it's the last Psalm, and I believe it's the third section in the Bible here. It ends the Psalms of Asaph. Asaph was one of the writers. He was a chief musician at the time of David, and he wrote many of these Psalms. So Psalm 83, notice, do not keep silent, O God. Some of you may remember, if you were around when 9/11 took place, that this was what we went to, talking about the Middle East and their problems, or basically the problems that the United States would have with them. So do not keep silent, O God. Don't hold your peace, and don't be still, O God. Why not? Or why, better yet? Why would they be saying, do not keep still? Well, because there's been attacks on the Middle East, or on Israel in the Middle East. So the people of God are saying, come to our rescue, is what's happening here. Your enemies make a tumult, and those who hate you have lifted up their head. Now, the Muslims do not like the God of Jacob. They like the God of Abraham because they think they're worshiping the God of Abraham. But when it comes to the God of Jacob, they don't like that God at all because their prophet doesn't come from Jacob. Not at all. So they hate the Christian God. They have taken crafty counsel against your people. These would be the people that God chose, not the strong of the world, but just the people God chose that would be his chosen people, and consulted against your sheltered ones. They have said, come and let us cut them off from being a nation. If you were over in Israel, you would know why it says sheltered ones, because they are in the middle of major problems. It's very interesting. When we were over there several years ago, we went to the feast in Jordan. When we went from Israel to Jordan, we saw there were guards on one side, the Israeli guards, in their tower, and the guards on the other side. So when we're coming out of Israel, the Israelis are at their machine guns, at their stations, looking very, very serious, no smiles, very alert, and you don't know if they're going to shoot you or not, because those guns are ready to go. And then you go to the other side. Actually, we were coming out of Jordan, so this is what we saw first, but here's the Jordans. Jordans are like this. You know, smoking away, having fun, you know, laughing. Nothing like the Israelis. So the Israelis are on alert. They're surrounded by enemies. Because remember, even Jordan attacked them several years ago. They learned not to attack them again because it was a disaster. It had been in the wars that you had in the 60s. It was tragic. So Jordan kind of became neutral, I guess we would say. And that's why they're going to be overpassed in the future, because they still are more of a neutral area. So you have in verse 4 them saying, let us cut off the name of Israel. Verse 5, they consulted together with one consent. And then latter half of verse 5, they form a confederacy. Now, when it comes to the king of the south, we think with all that's been going on, you think of the history of the king of the south, and the history of the south period of that area is, well, if you wrote a book on it, the joke is it's the shortest book ever written. It's called Arab Unity. The shortest book that's ever written. Because there's literally been no unity over there. Of course, there's this joke, too, of the two Israelis who jump in a swimming hole. And this is in 1930. They jump in a swimming hole, and while they're in the swimming hole, their clothes are stolen. And so they say, the Palestinians stole our clothes. The Arabs stole our clothes. And the Palestinians say, we weren't even around at that time, when they hear the joke. And the Jews say, that's right, you remember that. In other words, the Jews, it's been their land for a long time. Maybe the story goes back farther than that, actually, is probably why the joke. But whatever the case, you have everybody in the Middle East against the Israelis. So what do we have here? And you're going to see this, and we're not going to go through all the scriptures, but take a look at what we have here, and then we'll think back a little later when we'll go into a little bit more detail about the king of the south. The tents of Edom. So here's the confederate group. Now, if you're from that rebellious, horrible south of the United States, you think of Confederates, don't you? Well, the word Confederate is not a bad word. We Northerners like to pick on the Southerners once in a while. But you're friends. You're now in the church. We count you as a brother. It's tough sitting in the front row. It just is when you're from the South. Okay, but what we have then is it is a confederacy. They've joined together. It's Edom, Ishmaelites. That would be Esau. And then the Ishmaelites. You have Moab. And it's interesting as we go through some of these words here, some of these countries still around. Some of the words still are. You know, when you take a look at Egypt, where did the Egyptians come from? Well, they go back and Abraham went into Egypt. It's just like they have been around and the name has been around, the country's been around, and they've kept their name all of these years. Whereas it's not the same with other countries. But you take a look at Moab and Ammon, Jordan or Ammon Jordan, however you pronounce it, and that word has been around a long time, hasn't it? It's the capital of Jordan. So you have Ammon, you have Amalek, you have Philistia, you have Tyre, you have Assyria, you have the children of Lot. They're the ones that all get together. So you know that the Confederacy includes a number of countries. Just like when we talk about the King of the South, it includes a number of countries that the King of the North, that is, King of the North rules over. Deal with them as with Midian, as with Sisera, you can go back to the book of Judges in chapter 4, as with Jabin at the brook of Kishon, who perished at Endor, and he says, you know, basically destroy them. Oh my God, verse 13, make them like the whirling dust, like the chaff, as fire. So he's talking about the countries in the Middle East who hate Israel, who want to destroy it, and of course these countries still do. That's the point. The countries haven't changed. So when we think of King of the South that attacked the King of the North, you're thinking of what? Well, the Queen of Sheba was the Queen of the South, wasn't she? And when you look at countries that are overthrown by the King of the North, you know the area. You just definitely do. There's no question about King of the South. It's not South Africa that we're looking at. Okay, so we have those two areas, and we consider then by looking at those areas that these are the people that God will come down and maybe not destroy totally, but will fight against and deliver Israel. So, where can we go in the Bible for more detail on the King of the North and the King of the South? I think it's quite interesting. Well, Daniel 12. We know, and I won't stick with this too long, there's just a couple of verses that I'll read out of Daniel 12. We know, as I was saying, that the King of the North and King of the South are in existence at the time of the end, verse 40. At the time of the end, the King of the South attacks the King of the North. And that word attack is used in the New King James. The word push at, I think, is used in King James, but attack is a good word because, as I mentioned before, when you have the word push, anywhere else in the book of Daniel, it's talking about war. It's talking about aggressiveness. So you know that it is not just, well, we're going to withdraw your oil. It's just not that type of thing at all. Now, when you think of attack also, you have to have a lot of armament. And when we read about the King of the North, which we will do a little later here, you know that the King of the North is a strong entity with whom to deal. So you can't have just an ISIS group that's in trouble now and wants $200 million from Japan, is it, or China? They think they're in trouble. They've got a lot of money coming in, but not enough. And they don't have aircraft. If you're going to attack the description of this King of the North, you better have a lot of firepower. You had better. You can't just have a little Al-Qaeda group. So we're looking at these little piecemeal groups who want to take over in the Middle East, and there's no way that those groups can fight against the King of the North. Not at all. And we'll go to those scriptures in a bit showing that nobody has any chance against the King of the North. And I'll read you some details about the nature of this king of the north. So at the time of the end, the king of the south attacks him. And I bring that up so that we can describe the king of the south in a way where it's not just a little group. And it's not any group that's fighting in Syria. And it's not the Syrian army either, because they've been fighting back and forth, and no, there's no winner there yet at all. And the king of the north shall come against him, and notice how he comes, because this is a good description too of this king of the north in the future. It's like a whirlwind. And when a whirlwind comes, when a tornado comes, man, it's quick, it's fast, and it is destructive. Look at what happened down in, was it Joplin? A couple years ago. And it's like a whirlwind with chariots, tanks, you know, vehicles, armored vehicles, we would say, horsemen, many ships, and he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. Now, this is pretty powerful. The king of the south should read this before they even try, but they're not going to believe it. So what we see here with the king of the north and the king of the south, this is a description of the third to the last act, I guess, in the play. The second to the last act would be when the Asian countries attack this king of the north. And the last act is when God attacks those who have turned to attack him, that is, specifically Christ, whom God sends. So what do we know about the king of the south? Like I said, it's a history of disunity. They've never really been together, unless you can go back to some of the wars with the Muslims, when they would attack Jerusalem, and I suppose that'd be the closest thing, maybe in the Middle Ages, where you have some type of unity. But they... If you go into Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the prophecies, you see these countries that are listed, and we talked about the Confederacy. You see Egypt mentioned quite a few times. In fact, quite a few chapters on Egypt. Now, if you go into Janes, it is J-A-N-E-S, and you wonder why anybody would call a military arsenal book Janes, but that's the name of it. You see the countries and how much armament, how many airplanes, how many ships, how many destroyers they have. And you can buy it. You can order it. The latest one, they probably, you can probably have a subscription every year to get the latest one that comes out. And one of the most powerful countries that we would look at now would be Egypt. And when the king of the north counterattacks and goes down around the area of the king of the south, he goes all the way down to Egypt and Ethiopia. So he wants to get all of those that are the problem. So is the king of the north going to be a south that is from Egypt? So I'm asking questions to take up time because I don't know. I don't know, but you're going to have a country that has a lot of arsenal, as I mentioned, firepower, to go against the king of the north. And probably they have both Russian and U.S. jets, I suppose. I don't know. I haven't kept track of it. But you can get Janes and see what they have. But the point is, in all of this, Egypt is mentioned a lot. Moab is mentioned a lot. Edom probably is mentioned most after the country of Egypt, when you go into all of those. And I took a quick look. You have a chapter against such and such a country, a chapter against another country, chapter against another country, almost a whole book, Obadiah, against Edom and what Edom does. So, you know, Edom is in there, and Edom, we think that's Esau, of course. We think that's Turkey today. Turkey, who really wanted to get into the European Union, and because of non-religious affiliation has not been allowed to. Now, because of their religious affiliation, they have not been allowed to. They're not going to allow a Muslim country. So you have from all the way up in that sector, all the way down to Egypt, an area of the king of the south. We've said anything south of Jerusalem, but basically anything south of the king of the north. is more likely what it is. Or the areas that used to be the Roman Empire. So what do we have? We don't have much, but let's go to Obadiah. Just take a quick look here, and then we're going to spend some time on the king of the north. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah. And here is what we have with Obadiah. In fact, if I go into introductions to the book that I have here, it says a struggle that began in the womb between twin brothers Esau and Jacob. And that's why it says you've stood by, when you look read the book of Obadiah, you have stood by and you've watched captivity take captivity, I guess, is something to that effect. In other words, you stood by and watched your brother. You've allowed your brother to be taken captive, and you've done nothing. So in Obadiah, it's God concerning Edom. It's God's sayings concerning him. We come down to verse 7, the men at peace with you shall deceive you and prevail against you. Then he says in verse 9, to the end that every one from the mountains of Esau may be cut off by the slaughter. Verse 10, for your violence against your brother Jacob. So this is going to be against Edom. And because of what he did. Verse 12, you should not have gazed on the day of your brother in that day of captivity. Nor should you have rejoiced over the children of Judah. So, it's pretty specific, isn't it? So, Edom is one of those countries in the king of the south. Verse 15, as you've done, it shall be done to you. Your reprisal shall return upon your own head. And then he says in verse 17 and 18, latter part of verse 17, the house of Jacob shall possess their possessions. The house of Jacob shall be a fire. The house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau shall be a stubble. And no survivor, verse 18, shall remain of the house of Esau. So you know that they, if no survivor shall remain of the house of Esau, where does this put you? And what time frame does this put us? And the answer is at the time of the end. Esau is still around. And they're ones that are there as part of that confederacy that attacks. And you know that Turkey has pretty much some military power too. They do. Not as much as Egypt. Okay, finally let's go to just Amos, a couple scriptures in Amos. Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, just the chapter before. Excuse me, the book before. Amos 1, verse 6 and 9. It says, thus says the Lord, for three transgressions of Gaza and for four, I will not turn away its captivity, its punishment, because they took captive the whole captivity to deliver them up to Edom. So here is Gaza, actually, the Gaza Strip, you know, we call it. They're in cahoots also, just showing you that they have been with Edom, Esau. Verse 9, for three transgressions of Tyre, and for four, I will not turn away its punishment because they delivered up the whole captivity to Edom and did not remember the covenant of brotherhood. So they're in on it too. So we're dealing with brothers in the Middle East, cousins. We're dealing with Syria. We know that. Syria was around because Jacob married a Syrian. Remember? Since her brother was a Syrian, or the father was a Syrian, we figure she was a Syrian too. But Syria was around at that time. The name Syria has been around forever. So, in all of this, you have to have a confederacy. You can't have just one country. They know they're not big enough, and they know by this time that the king of the north is going to have a lot of countries that they're allied to also. And what sparks it, I don't know, but Allah, or going back to, or what do they say, deja vu all over again? Was that what was the Yankee catcher's name? But anyway, it's going to happen all over again that there's some spark that causes a war. And what it is, we don't know. We ask our question, though, or a question as we go along here, and that is it now? Can it happen now? I don't think so. I don't think it can happen now. I don't see anything like this at all. I don't see the North together. I don't see the South together. But that doesn't mean we eat and drink and be merry because we're not going to die yet. But we do watch what's happening, and a lot is going on. Okay, so King of the North, this is quite interesting. Go back to Daniel 7, and I mentioned when Daniel had this vision, there was something he especially wanted to know about. He wanted to know about this beast, this fourth beast. I'm going the wrong way here. Ezekiel, Daniel. The question has come up, by the way, why is Daniel mentioned in the restoration books? Why is it not in the prophetic books? And the answer is that Daniel is a restoration book, not in the prophetic book, because Daniel talks about the restoration coming to Israel from the time of its first captivity. So it was a nation, it was captured by the Gentiles, and the history that Daniel has visions of, prophecies of, takes you from the time of the captivity of Israel all the way until Christ returns, the restoration of Israel, or the real spiritual house of Israel on this earth. Daniel 7:19. So what was he interested in? Daniel 7 and verse 19. Then I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast. Now, there's been some explanation already, but I want to know the truth about that fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Now, what have we had so far in history? We've had Babylon. We've had the Medes, Persians. We've had the Roman Empire. Alexander the Great, the Greeks, of course. But the last one coming on the scene right before Christ returns, this one is the dreadful one. So I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, which was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful. Now, I might mention, just to let you know, that it's going to be exceedingly dreadful because the beast who heads these 10 nations has not been around too much, has not been in control. This beast is a different beast. It is a different beast. And we'll see as we go here. I wish to know the truth about the fourth beast, dreadful. Teeth of iron, nails of bronze, which devoured broken pieces, trampled the residue with its feet. And about the 10 horns that were on its head, and about the other horn which came up before which 3 fell. And I'm not going to include that in the sermon today, just because of time. But if we look at this, we see then the description in verse 23 through 26, 27. The fourth beast, verse 23, is different. It devours the whole earth. No beast before this time has devoured the whole earth. Devours the whole earth. Adolf Hitler wanted to do that, but he didn't even come close. This is why it's so different. The whole earth under this last beast. And the 10 horns are 10 kings. So you have a beast plus 10 kings. Who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. And then, of course, it talks about the pompous words of this religious leader. The saints are given into their hand for a time and times and a half a time. That's 3.5 years at the end. The court will be seated, verse 26, they shall take away his dominion to consume and destroy it forever. No more beast ever to rise up like this one. And then the kingdom and dominion and greatness of the kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people, the saints of the Most High. Return of Jesus Christ. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. So now with this, we ask, well, how does this beast form? And we go back to Revelation 17. Just two verses here. Revelation chapter 17. Why is it so different? Well, we have in verse 12, Revelation 17, in verse 12 through 14. The ten horns which you saw, okay, ten horns are on this beast, are ten kings who received no kingdom as yet, but they receive authority for 1 hour as kings with the beast. These are of one mind, and they will give their power and authority to the beast, and they end up making war with the Lamb. So you know at the time period that this is in. So you have ten kings who give their power to this beast. Now, why is this so different? If it were the Romans, Roman Empire, they were dreadful, but the Romans looked at another nation that they considered much worse than them. The other nation at that time, which was not a part of the Roman Empire. And it's a nation that the world experienced beginning in 1914 and again in 1939 actually. And that was the Germans. The Germans. The end time, the nations give their power to the Germans. It's the Germans that are really a problem. Joel 2 and verse 1 through 11. And basically, I think I only have three more scriptures to go to, but I'm going to read some references out of some books concerning what we think is this beast. But let's go to Joel 2, verses 1 through 11. Again, one of the so-called minor prophets. Hosea, second minor prophet, Hosea Joel. Joel chapter 2, and starting out in verse 1. Blow the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. When is this? The day of the Lord, we figure, is even the last year of the 3.5-year period. But whatever the case, it may generically include a few more years than that. It's a day of darkness, gloominess, clouds, thick darkness, like the morning clouds, a people great and strong, the like of whom has never been. And that's what Daniel had described to him. This is dreadful. This is unlike anything that's ever happened before. Nor will there ever be any such after them, even for many successive generations. Maybe he's talking about the end of the millennium. Who knows? In my mind, I'm wondering, why would God allow weapons to be made at the end of the millennium? So, whatever powers, I don't know. A fire devours before them, behind them a flame burns, the land is like the Garden of Eden before them, a desolate wilderness after them. Their appearance is like the appearance of horses, swift steeds, like a whirlwind, okay? So they run with a noise like chariots. Many chariots are going to come out of the north. Over mountaintops they leap, like the noise of a flaming fire that devours the stubble, like a strong people set in battle array. Before them the people writhe in pain, all faces are drained of color. They run like mighty men, they climb the wall like the men of war. Everyone marches in formation. They don't break their ranks. They don't push one another. Everyone marches in his own column, and when they lunge between the weapons, they're not cut down. They run to and fro, they run on the wall, they climb into the houses, they enter at the windows. The earth quakes before them, the heavens tremble. And you get the idea here. And where are they from? Verse 20, I will remove far away from you the northern army. It's the northern army that's coming down. Pretty much a description of the king of the north. Now, it's interesting that there has been one group historically that has been ferocious. And I'm taking this from a study that was done years and years ago, but I'll go right to the source that is mentioned as to what these people are like. He's talking about the Germans. In fact, the whole study was done about the Germans and the warlike people that they are. So, here we find And I'll just read from these sources. This is from Emil Ludwig on the Germans. Historians' description of the ancient German passion for war. Quote, the fact that they were all warriors was the only thing that remained common to the Teutonic tribes. Their heavens were battlefields, their gods warrior heroes, their popular assemblies army reviews. Political rule found expression solely in war command. Now, as you go through some of these descriptions here, it does say that they are peace-loving people, seemingly, and they really don't, at least of late, go to war a lot. And also, they follow the leader that's over them, and if they're a peaceful leader, they're peaceful. But if they get a leader that, pushes at their inferiority complex, because that's what they're described as having, then they rise up because they really think, the Germans really think that they're better than any other peoples when it comes to the arts, when it comes to economics, when it comes to war, definitely. They really feel that they're the top. There is a reason why you have the expression Deutschland über or über alles. That's Germany overall, because they really do feel that way. Is that their national anthem? Something like that. But anyway, the national anthem, I think, portrays a lot, too. Okay, going on here, you find from the entire, let's see, this is from the Führer Teutonicus that the Romans coined the expression. So here you have the Romans talking about the German tribes. The entire German society in those early days was geared for war. It was something the Romans and other nations surrounding these German tribes dreaded. Now, why would you have the Romans dread the Germans? The Romans coined this word, the Furious Teutons. It happened often whenever German warriors were charging that they would collectively chant in a shouting manner a war song to terrify their enemies. They would also, Tacitus tells us, he's a historian, charge the enemy with lightning-like speed, something that we in the 20th century now know as blitzkrieg. And it happened. Now, going on here, another quote. Going on to the 3rd and 5th centuries, the Franks, and this is coming from the development of the German public mind, the Franks were a particularly warlike people, states Frederick Hertz. It says the aggressive war-making of the German Franks was conspicuous to other warring peoples. So the most warring nations of the earth said, if you want warriors, then you've got the Germans. And the Romans actually hired the Germans to fight the Germans. And these were basically the Hessians who became lazy when Washington was attacking that night when he crossed the Hudson River, was it? With the Hudson, was that right? Because he beat the Hessians, but they were drinking. That's another thing the Germans are really known for, is their beer, but they're drinking. And they pride themselves in being able to outdrink anybody under the table. So, anyway, going on, this is from Frederick Hertz again. It says, the Germans are described by him as warlike and invincible in battle, loyal to their princes unto death and trusting only men of their own tribe. Going on, it's amazing during World War II how they even got the youngsters to fight. This is from German's National Vice. And it's talking about Frederick the Great in the 18th century, so we're moving along here. And he said, he's a fool, and that nation is a fool who, having the power to strike his enemy unawares, does not strike and strike his deadliest. Frederick the Great is rightly looked upon as the founder of modern German militarism. This is from the same source here, German National Vice. Not entirely as a state policy, but as a worship of destruction for its own sake. Nice people. Now, when they're converted all over. Okay. And I think probably we have a lot of individuals who come from a German background and they're converted. So we're not talking about at the end time all Germans everywhere from every location will rise up. Of course not. This is talking about the German people overall who under the right leader or the wrong one will rise up. And then finally, just one more quote. And this is from Open the Road for Culture Once and for All. Okay. Thousands of German Christians will breathe again when they see the ships of the German Navy, and this is the Kaiser and his times. Thousands of German Christians will breathe again when they see the ships of the German Navy in their vicinity. Hundreds of German merchants will shout for joy in the knowledge that the German Empire has at long last set firmly in Asia. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese will shiver if they feel the iron fist of the German Empire. Goes on, they will see the German Emperor as a bad person, and that's what we want. And then down below, give the world an example of virility and discipline. Discipline. And anyone who falls into your hands falls to the sword. Take no prisoners. Tough. Why am I looking on this side mostly? We have mostly... I'll pick on you the next time here around. Okay, so quite interesting, isn't it? And then when it comes to their nature and not knowing their nature, in Isaiah 10, it's talking about the Assyrians there, and we feel the Assyrians actually migrated north to where the Germans are now. But it says God is using them as a tool to strike Israel, but it's not in their heart to do so, which is interesting. It's not in their heart to do so. Here's some other quotes from some of these sources here. First quote, Germany, the symbol and the deed. We all know this, of course. The Germans are more efficient than the French, more civilized than the Russians and the nations of the East, bolder than the Swiss, the Dutch, the Danes, and all the other small nations. Boasting just a little bit. We are harder than the rest, they say. The only thing we are not is more humane. But this does not matter. We leave humanitarian sentimentality to the others. Now, this is someone who looks at the nations, but the people themselves don't know that this is their nature. You have so many comments like this, and I'll just go to two more here, of the nature of the Germans. This is from Frederick Holderlin. He's a German poet born in 1770. So this is going back a ways. It is a harsh thing to say, and yet I say it because it is true. I know of no people more torn apart than the Germans. You will see craftsmen, but no human beings. Philosophers, but no human beings. Priests, but no human beings. And this reminds you a little bit of the Apostle Paul, who said, was it the Sicilians who are slow bellies, or what group was that that he said? You know, they were known for that. The Germans are known for this. Their own poet, the Apostle Paul would say, masters and servants, young people and settled folk, but no human beings. It is not like a battlefield where hands and arms and broken limbs lie scattered while the spilled lifeblood drains into the sand. Whatever that meant, it's poetry. So you can see that this nature that is there, and God says, I'm using them as my instrument to attack and to attack Israel and Judah, and especially Jerusalem. Because they will come in and they will overtake Jerusalem. And then finally, a nation fulfilling their destiny. In fact, I don't even know if I have time on that. Let me go to Revelation. But basically, they feel that they're destined to be the masters of the world. There's quite a few quotes on that from different authors. they feel they're destined, that this is their calling, their destiny. And when they get a leader, one woman said, it's a good thing now, this is with the Führer, Adolf Hitler, it's a good thing that we have another Savior that's come along like Christ. It's like, man. And now it's interesting, and I'm not reading this part here, but it's interesting that Adolf Hitler stated, once we get rid of the Jews, then we're going to get rid of Christianity. He did not like the Ten Commandments at all. He said, nature gives us our commandments. So, we come finally then to this last scripture in Revelation 13, 1 through 7. Notice this description of the beast out of the sea. Then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and 10 horns. So you see these 10 horns again that are going to give their power to the beast. And on his horns, 10 crowns, and on his heads, a blasphemous name. Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard. So he has everything that the previous beasts had. The dragon gives him authority, his power, his throne, and great authority. And then talks about one of the heads wounded, but then comes back to life. Verse 4, they worshiped the beast and gave authority to the beast. They said, who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him? Well, the king of the south tries and doesn't make it. There's only one other group that's going to try, and that is when the king of the north establishes his headquarters just outside Jerusalem, just a little bit to the west it would be, toward the Mediterranean Sea. So he establishes his headquarters there, and then, of course, there's the attack of the Russians, the Chinese, the Japanese, the Cambodians, the Indians, the Pakistans, or Pakistanis, however you call it. You have all of those groups, and they're building up, so we watch them too, don't we? He was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he's given authority for just 3.5 years. That's all, just 3.5 years. And then it says, verse 7, it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them in authority. So same thing as Daniel 7. He's given authority to overcome them. Authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation. So this is the first time you have him over the whole earth, over every tribe, tongue, and nation. Is he a Christian? If he has the same attitude as Adolf Hitler, I don't think he's going to be a Christian. That was a stupid question, wasn't it? Is he a Christian? Does he claim Christianity, in quotes, as his belief? Is he going to be Roman Catholic? What is this other beast? And the answer is, well, we've always thought, but who knows what he's going to turn out to be. So we take a look at him, and just a couple other quotes here from a couple of books. And I guess this is what, I guess I am going to read what I thought I wasn't. Historically speaking, stated Hitler, Christian religion is nothing but a Jewish sect. This is from Hitler. This is from the book, The Ten Commandments by Hermann Rauschning. It was always been, it will remain just that as long as it exists. Then he said, after the destruction of Judaism, the extinction of Christian slave morals, not the Christians, must follow logically. I shall know the moment when to confront, for the sake of the German people and the world, their Asiatic slave morals, meaning the Ten Commandments, with our picture of the free man, the godlike man. And then finally, one other quote from the same source. We must free ourselves of all sentimentality and become hard. What impresses is cruelty and brute force. Nature is cruel, therefore we must be cruel too. So you think we've had some bad leaders And there had been a lot of bad leaders, but I think we can see why Daniel was so interested in this fourth beast that rules over the whole earth. And Christians are going to be under the control. In other words, they will have to flee or die as a martyr, probably. And God will have a place of safety for many, but there will be martyrs. So as we look at the two kings, we see that there's a lot behind it. We see history behind both groups. We see prophecies concerning both kings, I should say. We know where one is coming from, the north. We know the southern area. We know the attacks that are going to take place. We know so much more. But all of this should make us think, how did God know all this? And maybe he knows how we can gain salvation, and maybe he knows what we must do to enter life. He knows maybe we should keep those commandments that Adolf Hitler doesn't want us to keep. Any prophecy should just drive us on to live a righteous life. That's what it should do. Because we may not be living when some of these things happen, especially those of us who are older. We don't know if it's going to be 5 years. You always have people saying it's going to be the next 15 to 20 years it is going to happen. So there's going to be a time when it is the next 15 to 20 years. And then no one's going to scoff at all. But there is a time coming. And brethren, we need to be close to God. In fact, there is a scripture that tells us in Hebrews 10 that we must make sure that we keep the Sabbath holy, that we fellowship so much more as we see the day approaching. So we have to do that. And during the week, we have to live a righteous life and be a light to this world. So I hope all these prophecies and what God knew and the fact that there is a king of the north that's coming on the scene and the people that God has prepared to do his work for him and a king of the south and all the rest is put together like pieces of chess on a chessboard that God brings together in a position to bring about the time of the end. I hope all of that stirs us on to worship, honor, and obey God.